Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
There is a few infuriating bits in today's case, and not just that a lovely and young and vibrant young woman was murdered. That part is always infuriating to me. But there's some other stuff that kind of gets my knickers in a bunch today.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I am not guilty.
Brittany Zimmerman knew by her first year of high school that she wanted to go to Wisconsin-Madison College to become a doctor, and she was very goal-oriented. She stayed in contact often with her school guidance counselor at Marshville High to make sure that she was picking the right classes and was on track for the academics that she needed for med school. She also understood that extracurricular activities were important to college admissions. So she was also in the school band, the Spanish club. She did a lot of volunteer work at the American Cancer Society. Kevin and Jean Zimmerman's daughter was one of those kids who just kind of seemed to come out of the womb with her head screwed on straight. She did not get into any trouble. She never took her eyes off the prize. And of course, she did make it into University of Wisconsin-Madison and had made the dean's list 2 years in a row while she was there. And the plan for her was to specialize in infectious diseases. And in 2008, she was 21 years old. She was attending University of Wisconsin-Madison, living at 517 West Doughty Street in downtown Madison. She was engaged to Jordan Gonnering, who had transferred to Wisconsin-Madison specifically to be with her. She had already started making her wedding plans, which were going to be in Hawaii on a beach in her bare feet, was excited about the wedding, her career opportunities, and of course, having kids one day. And West Doughty Street had, though, some issues. So it was really kind of important to keep your doors locked in that area. The street was prone to panhandlers that were looking for drug money. And sometimes if you weren't careful, they would actually brazenly walk into like an unlocked apartment and then rifle through your stuff. So Brittany was a careful woman to begin with. She always made sure to keep her doors and all of her windows locked, both when she was away and when she was home as well. And to earn a bit of money through school, she worked at the registrar's office taking student records and then scanning them and indexing them. It was, I mean, tedious work for most people, but Brittany had kind of come up with this system of not just organizing them, but of also of making it kind of fun to do the work as well. She always worked with a smile. That's what her coworkers always said about her. And it's really hard to convey how very loved and cared for and really special Brittany was, not just to her family, but anyone that came in contact with her. She was just a really lovely young woman. And on April 2nd, 2008, Brittany left her classes around 11:30 that morning and headed through Van Hise Hall on the Wisconsin-Madison campus. She was talking to Jordan on her cell phone as she was walking, and Jordan could see her from the balcony above as he was watching her. You know, she's moving with purpose like she always did. And at 11:57, she returned a call from Jordan's sister, left a voice message for her, and then she called her mom's workplace. It was at the Marshfield Clinic where her mom worked. It was a regular thing that she did, but Jean's phone didn't have a voicemail connected to it, but her name came up on the caller ID. But Jean wasn't at her desk at the time and missed the call, but did see her name come up on the caller ID and then planned that she would call her back around 3 when she was done for the day. Well, at 12:20, a call came in to 911 from Brittany's address. The dispatcher claims that she didn't hear anything on that call that warranted any concern, so she let the call drop. However, we're going to come back to this in a little bit. At 1:08, Jordan arrived at Brittany's house or apartment to find the door had been forced open, and to his horror and shock, Brittany was laying on the floor in the main room of the apartment covered in blood, like so much blood that he actually assumed she'd been shot. And he called 911 himself, and through his tears and screams, he was asked to look into her mouth to make sure that there wasn't anything obstructing her airway. But all he could really notice about her was that she was so cold and that her fingers were stiff and there was blood like all over her face. So when the paramedics and the police arrived shortly after, of course, Jordan, whose face was as white as a sheet with his, just this blank stare on his face, the only thing he could repeat over and over was, "She was the nicest person ever. Like, who would do this?" So Brittany was declared dead at 1:34 p.m. on April 2nd, 2008, less than 2 hours after Jordan had watched her leave campus, heading home to make their wedding arrangements or do whatever she was going to do. Jean had arrived home that afternoon to find a police cruiser in her driveway and Kevin sitting at the table with his head bent low, who informed her that somebody had just murdered their baby girl. And the murder seemed just inconceivable to her to have happened in like the middle of the day with so many people around. Like, it was literally like lunch hour on a busy street. Now, I have the details of like the search warrants and the investigation and all that kind of important stuff because this case has now concluded. But when a family member of yours is murdered, which of course I hope never happens to you, you get no details at all. Like, you don't get timelines, how your person died, any of the circumstances. You can't have access to their phones. Like, there's just nothing. The police hold everything back in order to preserve the integrity of the investigation. And like, as family members, we understand that, but absolutely no healing can take place for anyone when you don't have any of that information because of the scenarios that you imagine in your own mind. Like, just the pain of not knowing anything is actually probably worse than the pain of the loss itself. So Jean and Kevin and her younger brother, Matthew, who was only 16 at the time, were left in this kind of grieving purgatory for years because, although the police refused to call this a cold case, it did go unsolved for years. And how this case actually gets solved is just as infuriating as Brittany's murder itself.
Photos only paint a portion of the young woman Brittany Zimmerman was.
If you ever have a chance to have a daughter, you would want her to be Brittany, because she was an amazing, amazing daughter.
2 years after the UW-Madison student's murder, Brittany Zimmerman's mother, Jean, and her aunt, Kim, like a sister to Brittany, continue to wait for answers.
You know, I pray to God tomorrow's the day. And for almost 2 years, we've prayed every night that the next day is going to be that day, and it has not come.
That person needs to be off the street
that person needs to not be able to enjoy their day-to-day life. There needs to be as much of a consequence as there can be.
The autopsy results had come back as cause of death of a complexity of traumatic injuries, which was a little bit more detailed in the report as complex homicidal violence, including multiple stab wounds and strangulation, and so many stab wounds to the chest that Jordan had actually immediately assumed that it had been an exit wound from like a rifle. She also had some blunt force trauma that appeared that she may have been beaten before she was stabbed and then strangled. The knife used was likely 2 to 5 inches with a width of about 3/4 of an inch. Now, the knife itself was not found at the scene, though it has never been recovered. Jean and Kevin had Brittany cremated after her body was returned to them. And before being cremated, Jordan had slipped the engagement ring that he had ordered at the time that they got engaged, but they hadn't picked it up yet. And it was one that she had designed herself. Jean had this impression of her thumb put on this charm to wear around her neck. They would not actually take her ashes to the cemetery for a few years following her death, feeling just a little bit more comfort at having her with them. But answers as to what or who had happened to Brittany would have to, of course, wait. Collected from Brittany's apartment was a pair of bloody women's slippers. There was a paper towel with some blood on it. All of her kitchen knives were taken, her computer and her bedding. 18 blood samples were taken from various different places, and 23 swabs for DNA and 10 fingerprints were found, and 9 partial footprints as well. They also grabbed the sink traps for any trace evidence that might have been there, had maybe somebody cleaned up or something afterwards. Most of her valuables were still there when she had been murdered. Her backpack was still there, her purse, a camera, and her iPod, as well as a diamond ring that she had. There was no mention in the reports of a phone, although it did mention cell phone parts. But there was one very important detail that was withheld from Kevin and Jean that would lead the family to taking some legal action. Brittany had called 911 as she was being attacked, so about half an hour before Jordan had arrived. And the recording of this phone call was all but kind of buried in the investigation records. And they had their reasons for keeping that call quiet. I mean, as a matter of holdback evidence, there wasn't really much of an evidentiary value in the call. But there was something on the call that could have proved maybe important to possibly saving Brittany before it was too late. According to the dispatcher that had taken the call, there were no sounds to be heard on there, like no screaming, no sounds of any struggle. So the call was dropped and the police were not dispatched, like not even an ambulance. However, according to the investigation files, which were initially ordered sealed, and then the seals would kind of like expire and then they'd be extended over the years. But after a couple of times of it getting expired and then having it resealed, it expired again. And then someone didn't bother to request to have them resealed. So during that time, the State Journal grabbed them and made them public, which was the first that the family had ever heard any details at all. And they didn't hear them from the police, but from a reporter from the State Journal. But anyways, according to Detective Marion Morgan, regarding this 911 call, she said the disconnect call started with the sound of a woman screaming, and the line remains active and open, picking up the background sounds of a struggle for a short period of time. So how then did this dispatcher decide that there were no sounds at all? Well, apparently that part wasn't entirely true, because a screening of the call could quite easily hear a scream, but the operator didn't register it as a scream. The operator that I'm not going to name, of course, was interviewed about the call on 3 separate occasions. In this first interview, she said that she didn't hear a scream, but heard some background noises, including voices, but didn't register anything as anyone in obvious distress. That's a direct quote. The call itself is about a minute long, and anyone listening to it was able to find the location of the call at Brittany's apartment within about the first 24 seconds of the call. And the report reads that this particular dispatcher is a dedicated county employee who is an outstanding, competent dispatcher with an exemplary 20-year work record. She did not hear any sounds of distress from the caller. Had she heard any signs of distress, she would have responded appropriately as she did throughout her career. In the second interview, she said that she had recently answered a similar call and followed the protocol, creating a call for service. Now, had she heard sounds of something serious, she said she would have done the same thing. And then she added that she had called the number back and spoke with a man who said that he had misdialed, but she didn't log that as a call. But that's new information, and it's not correct. The second call was actually from Jordan, and that call during it had somehow become disconnected, and she had called him back, and that's when she created a call for service. So by the time she was interviewed a third time about it, she said she didn't know why she hadn't called Brittany's phone back other than that she was busy with other calls. So this clusterfuck caused the family to file a lawsuit against Dane County, which was settled out of court. They were able to, of course, maintain the stance that they had complied with all the laws and regulations regarding 911 calls.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Well, Susan, this lawsuit dates back to 2008 when Dane County refused to release a 911 tape and other documents after it was discovered a 911 operator mishandled an emergency call from Brittany Zimmerman. Zimmerman was found dead, stabbed, and strangled to death in her downtown apartment in April of 2008. Shortly thereafter, it was learned Zimmerman did actually make a call to 911, but the dispatcher said she did not hear any signs of a struggle. In contradicting policy, she did not send help.
There were substantial revelations that came out as a result of this lawsuit, including the fact that the tape did contain sounds of a struggle and screaming. That was brought into the public domain as a result of this lawsuit.
But at least during all of this time, the police were working the case. I mean, they weren't really telling the family anything about what they were doing, leaving them again in limbo. But they had a theory, at least, that whoever had killed Brittany had been like a drifter in the area who had gained entry by force, probably looking for cash. They did take DNA samples from about three different men that were living homeless in the area, but they were cleared. I mean, they were arrested for other things, as were about another two dozen men in the area, but for other things rather than murder. And after all of these investigation files were inadvertently released, the police issued a statement that was really helpful for everyone, saying it's possible the suspect or suspects are in custody at this time. It's also possible the suspect or suspects are still on the street.
Monday will mark 10 years since a brutal murder that rocked downtown Madison. That homicide remains unsolved tonight, despite some leads in the case.
Do you think about that day?
Every day. Every single day.
And we thought it was going to be solved right away. We didn't even consider that we'd be here 10 years later.
Yes, thank you. That was very helpful information. Well, not long before Brittany's murder, earlier that same day, a man had entered another apartment where a number of young students were living on West Washington Avenue. And he had come in through an unlocked door and then ran off when he was confronted. He was arrested on a parole violation. So that's what gave them this theory that Brittany's murder had been like a transient looking for drug money. They also felt very strongly that the murderer was not anyone that was known to Brittany, but somebody knew something, because it was the middle of the day on a very busy street, and there were screams heard, even if they didn't want to admit that they were heard on the 911 call. But no one came forward with any information. A Wisconsin Whitewater student named Kelly Nolan had last been seen after bars closed on State Street, and her body had been found in a wooded area in July of 2007. So the police kind of wondered if maybe the two cases had been committed by the same person, but they didn't really want to comment on to why they believed that any further than saying that they were, you know, both a year apart, they were both likely by strangers, and both young college-aged women. Jean and Kevin continued to wait for any information that they could get, like any sign that they were getting close. And 2 years after Brittany's murder, they issued a statement that read in part, "Until you have lived the life that our family has endured for the past 2 years, you simply cannot understand the true extent of our emotions. Fear and heartbreak rule our everyday lives. Fear that until this individual is taken off the streets, he will continue to victimize others. And heartbreak that we may never have justice for Brittany, and that others may experience the loss that we have endured, consumes our every thought." They raised $15,000 for a reward for information leading to an arrest, which was pretty much securing for someone out there their entire life savings. But they just wanted someone to come forward and do what they felt was the right thing, and to, you know, speak to the police about anything that they might have known, like an estranged girlfriend or someone that had heard something, or just really anything. They also fought to have like DNA collections expanded to not just someone who's maybe convicted of a felony, but also some types of misdemeanors, as like criminal behavior tends to escalate. So being convicted of, say, a break and enter, and then at that time having your DNA added to the databank, then could possibly lead to solving like a rape or murder down the road. But it wasn't until December of 2016, though, that a DNA sample from Brittany's shirt had come back with a hit. But I'm not sure it was one of those one in a trillion matches, though. But it came back to a guy named David Call, who was serving time for his 7th drunk driving conviction. He was also a registered sex offender, but I don't have any details on those particular cases. He was currently in the prison's early release program, undergoing some drug treatment program there. And David Call, it turns out, was one of the first people that the police interviewed back in 2008 about Brittany's murder. He had admitted at the time to being in the neighborhood that day, and he was going door to door asking for $40 to buy crack. But he had never been a suspect at the time for whatever reason, even though they were pretty sure from the beginning that it had to have been somebody just like David that had committed the crime. But other than these sex offenses, which again, I don't have any details on, David had all like non-violent criminal charges up to that point. Despite this DNA match that they had, they didn't feel that they had enough for a conviction, calling DNA circumstantial evidence, which is very strange to me. I mean, it connects him as a complete stranger to Brittany on the day that she was murdered. But I guess without CCTV footage of him actually committing the crime, he could possibly claim that he came to the door and, I don't know, hugged her or something, and then she just happened to be murdered like seconds later.
The parents of Brittany Zimmerman, the UW-Madison student killed in her apartment in 2008, say a DNA match has been made in their daughter's homicide investigation. In a statement, Kevin and Jean Zimmerman say they're not releasing this person's name since the district attorney's office isn't ready to file charges. They're confident multiple people might have detailed information about Brittany's murder.
But they did speak to this jailmate, who was a guy named Andrew Schools, who told police, "I can tell you that David broke down in tears one morning and confessed to me all what had happened, if I can remember it right. Hypothetically, he broke down and told me all that had happened." Well, that's not very much to go on. But Andrew decided that it was a good opportunity to kind of work the system and offered up this confession and all that David had told him during this breakdown that he had. But he wanted some of the charges against himself dropped first. He had a number of misdemeanors by that point for things like drugs, weapons, etc. And of course, violating restraining orders, going back to 1996. Quote, "I'm not saying I'm an angel, I'm a rebel, I'll admit that. I'll admit I've done some bad things, but I'm not a bad guy, I'm not a violent guy," end quote. But he had gotten this possession charge for having just over an ounce of marijuana on him. And because it was his second possession charge, it made it a felony, which meant that they confiscated his gun collection from him. You cannot have guns if you're a felony convict. So he wanted the felony part dropped, but in order for that to happen, he was going to need a presidential pardon. So he said to himself, well, hey, the Zimmermans want justice for their daughter. Maybe they'll just write a letter to Obama for me. I mean, he's pardoned more people than any other president. It's not like I'm asking for a pardon for a murder case or a carjacking or something. I don't think I'm asking for much. Now, he did not get that. And he felt like if he didn't get that, well, then he was just going to do his time and the Zimmermans could suck it. Quote, "I don't want to play games, but I don't see what choice I have," end quote. Now, Jean did confirm that Andrew had, in fact, reached out to her by email saying, "He told me that he's a man of honor. I told him to be a man of honor and do the right thing. He has a daughter himself. What if what happened to Brittany happened to his daughter? He'd be doing the same thing I'm doing. But he refuses to do it, and I don't understand why not." And I also don't understand why not. He never did turn David over and rat on him. Instead, in August of 2017, after being released from prison just by time served, he was killed in a motorcycle accident. So there was still no justice for Brittany, but they were sure that this David was their guy. But I guess the one DNA match just wasn't enough for the DA's office to go ahead with charges. But at least he was still at the time serving time, just not for murder. But he was also in this early release program and would be getting out soon. So finally, in February of 2020, a second DNA hit came back to David from Brittany's jeans this time. So now with two DNA hits on Brittany's clothing, they felt they had the evidence enough and they arrested him. And it was just literally days before he was set to be released. The charge now was for first degree intentional homicide.
On April 2nd, 2008, almost 12 years ago, Brittany Zimmerman was killed in her downtown Madison apartment. Today, I can announce that criminal charges have been filed in her death. David Call, a 53-year-old male, has been charged in Dane County Circuit Court with first-degree intentional homicide as a party to a crime and with a dangerous weapon.
In June 2021, he was declared competent to stand trial, and the preliminary hearing was held in July of 2021. There was found to be enough evidence to go forward with a trial, at which he pled not guilty, but then changed that to a guilty plea on October 27th of 2022. Now, as part of this plea deal, he had to promise not to contest any parole supervision after his release on these murder charges, which did come with a life sentence, but with release potentially like 20 years down the road. But during the sentencing hearing, he himself asked that he not be released early.
some peace for the family of a UW-Madison student who was killed in her apartment more than 14 years ago. 56-year-old David Call was sentenced to life in prison today after agreeing to a plea deal.
And are you pleading guilty because you did intentionally cause the death of Brittany Zimmerman?
Yes, Your Honor.
While running his door-to-door scam in the neighborhood, he stopped at Zimmerman's home. High on drugs and paranoid, he lost it when he saw Zimmerman on the phone. Brittany's fiancé would find her later, stabbed and strangled.
It was much more about him letting go of a secret and making sure that he provided closure to all of the people who have spent a lot of time and energy and emotion.
For the whole family, the heartbreak is hardly over.
I'm glad that he feels he has a free conscience at this point, but we, as a family, have nothing but pain. We have nothing but daily reminders, and we've had nothing but torture for 14 and a half years.
When you take someone's life, you take a lot of other people's lives too in the process. And there's a lot of broken hearts here, I know.
And the motive for the crime? Well, he was high. And I guess that's supposed to answer that question for the family. Jean and Kevin have an annual scholarship for students at Marshville High. They continue to raise money for the Marshville Pet Shelter. They want to build a new facility with a free roaming cat room. Brittany had been, she'd been a cat mom to three cats, and she just adored animals completely, especially cats. And Jean said of Brittany at the time, "She may be gone, but we will never let people forget who she was and what she meant to us." And that was the very sad murder of Brittany Zimmerman. And I'm going to be back again next week with another case. I hope you will join me then. I thank you for joining today. Feel free to do your things with, I don't know, comments, reviews, etc. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
I'm Mandy.
And I'm Avery.
We're the hosts and creators of Thick Thighs and Creepy Vibes.
Join us as we take a deep dive into the macabre and the unexplained.
Listen every Wednesday as we take you on a chilling journey that transports you to all corners of the Great White North.
Let's boot those Sunday scaries while we take a rip into the harrowing tales of the haunted and the supernatural phenomena that defy explanation.
So grab your ketchup chips.
And your Caesars. And make sure to
creep it real.